The American politician Lady Bird Johnson once said, "Encourage and support your kids because your children are apt to live up to what you believe of them." Welcome to the Mamafesto podcast, where parenting and politics combine and we look at what impact that has on public policy. This week, my guest is Laura Rose. Laura Rose is one of the founders of LGBT Mummies, a global community supporting the LGBTQ plus communities around the world to have their journey to parenthood and be seen by our healthcare services. Laura Rose, thank you so much for joining us today on the Mamafesto. This podcast is about how parenting and politics can combine. You set up what to me is an extraordinarily powerful organisation, bringing your own personal experience of parenting and the journey to parenting to trying to change public policy. Why don't we start, if you just tell us a little bit about how the group that you set up came about?
Yeah, so thank you for having me. My wife and I, we've been together 17 years, married 13. And when we started our journey to motherhood, and I say mother because we both identify as mums, it was just really isolating. It was really discombobulating, to be honest, because there was no safe space for people like us. There was no one of lived experience that we could ask the questions, the burning questions that we had at the time that so many come to us with. You know, how much did it cost? What are the pathways? What does that look like? What are the legalities involved? And ensuring that we had that safe space to ask those questions, but also meet others, was crucial. So by the time we had our second child, I was breastfeeding him on the sofa. He was like a week old. And for like the umpteenth time, we'd been contacted, you know, through social media, in the supermarket, you know, through friends of friends in the workplace. How did you have the kids? How much did it cost? All those questions. And I just said, we need to do something. We need to create, you know, a community or an organisation out of our purpose as a force for good to support people like us so that they don't have the experiences that we had. So we did it. We just set up socials. And within 6 months, we were meeting the Prime Minister at Downing Street. We were doing campaigns with Stonewall. And it just blew up, Stella. It was just quite astounding. We didn't realise there was such a need. And now, you know, we have a global community of around 70,000 people that we support. We celebrate and utilise LGBTQ plus women's families and peoples. And we provide that support. So private support groups connecting to organisations that provide that clinical or professional remit that sits outside of ours. It just felt like a need. And then it kind of blew into looking at the policy and the law reform side of things, because there were so many spaces that we were navigating that we found that there was no equity, that it wasn't equal in access. And there were barriers to LGBTQ plus parents accessing care, accessing support, or accessing legal rights that heterosexual people have. So yeah, over the years, the policy and campaign work has just kind of grown.
I think people don't realise, frankly, how difficult getting fertility treatment, fertility support is already. And then you layer on top of that a lack of understanding about the kind of families that you're talking about. And it's really easy to see how frustrating it is. Just talk us through some of the barriers and just explain to people who may not have been through that journey themselves what you mean.
I mean, there's so many, there's a multitude of barriers that impact people accessing not only fertility treatment, adoption, fostering, you know, whatever your family makeup is. As an LGBTQ plus person, those barriers are already there, whether it's legally, financially, accessing healthcare, accessing funding, you know, the usual barriers of discrimination, erasure of a community or an identity or sexuality, whatever that might be. So having to overcome all of those barriers alongside trying to go through fertility treatment or trying to start a family, you know, having miscarriages, suffering baby loss, suffering, you know, failed cycles, all of those difficulties that anyone going on that parenting journey goes through, on top of that, and the intersectionality of being black or brown and dealing with racism, dealing with ableism because you're disabled or have neurodivergent, you know, all of those other marginalized minority communities, if you tick more than one box and you're LGBTQ plus, that's a lot of barriers to overcome. So a lot of people find that sometimes that's too great and the implications can be absolutely huge, financially, physically and psychologically.
So Laura, one of the things I think people don't realise is that the rules that the NHS have put in place for same-sex couples accessing fertility treatment don't really make any sense in the real world. For example, it actually requires female same-sex couples to have failed at trying to get pregnant first before they can access fertility treatment. I did biology at school. I know that's a daft rule. What is it like for people to experience that kind of, well, frankly, incomprehension of what life is like for LGBTQ couples in the NHS?
Well, the thing is, as well, like you said, Stella, that the guidelines are so evasive and there's such a grey area that it's no man's land for many people just trying to understand what constitutes as that. Is it having treatment in a private clinic and having failed cycles? Because that is usually what they constitute as failed cycles 6 to 12 before they'll consider you for access to funded treatment. Or is it in the home with a known donor? And again, people don't know because some have spoke to their ICBs to be told, oh no, you have to have it in a clinic, which then obviously isn't equitable because people are unable to afford to go through a clinic. So say, well, no, we've tried it at home with a known donor that we found that we want to start a family with or co-parent with or use as a donor. But that's not okay either. So the ICBs are all kind of doing their own thing. So when people are coming to us, they're saying,
You mean the NHS trust, basically,
to
provide the service.
Yeah, because it's the trust that provides a service, but the integrated care board that sits above them that holds the purse strings. And they're the ones that set those guidelines or set those parameters within their own trust. So they're being told, well, actually, no, you've got to have 6 to 12 failed cycles before. And people are like, is that home insemination? Is that natural intercourse? Or is that through a clinic? You know, and they go, oh, well, we don't know. We'll have to go away and check. So it's really evasive. There's not a lot of information about it. So when people come to us, they're like, what constitutes as a failed cycle? And also what people forget is LGBTQ plus people, female same-sex couples currently, if you go down the route of a private funded treatment outside of the NHS, anything between £1,500, £1,800, up to £25,000 before the NHS will say, we'll give you access to treatment, where a heterosexual couple will go to the doctor and say, you know, we've been trying for 2 years or whatever, you know, the criteria is, we can't get pregnant. And the doctor goes, okay, I'll refer you for treatment because you have access to funding. They don't have to spend a penny. And that's where we're trying to explain it's not equitable because £25,000 out of pocket. And in that time, most people will get pregnant unless there's a real underlying fertility condition, whereas a heterosexual couple don't. So people come to us confused, upset, distressed, or going, we're never going to have a child. And they're the calls and the late night, you know, Zooms that we have with people going, we're never going to get a child in our first chosen route. And we believe it's a human right, if medically viable, that you get the ability or chance to have a child by your first chosen route, at least have that chance. But yeah, our community are not getting that access.
And how do you feel the NHS responds to the needs of your community? I mean, what's it like to be going through treatment in the NHS as an LGBTQ person right now?
There are a lot of really, really good midwives, good clinicians, good people in the NHS. You know, there are a lot of people that really want to do good, but they're not being given the training and the tools by the government to support understanding our community, our identities, our sexualities, our pathways, our routes to family creation. And, you know, we do a lot of work with the NHS, NHS Scotland and organisations to support that. So they have those training and tools. But sending a midwife or healthcare professional into their day-to-day job and then they don't know how to support someone like me, for example. But going into those spaces right now for many people, especially trans and non-binary people, is really scary, especially under the current political climate right now for our community. People are afraid. People are going in and it's no man's land. So I don't know, Stella, if you saw last week we announced a new free resource for midwives to share with service users, but also for our community to take once you get to that point of pregnancy. Thank goodness that some do get that opportunity to share the information about your background and who you are and your journey so that you are safer, you are getting personalised continuity of care, and you're not having to out yourself at every turn or feel unsafe. And, you know, as an organisation, we wanted to do that. We wanted to put that out there so people didn't have the experience we did. But sadly, we shouldn't be the ones doing it. We should be co-producing this with trusts. And, you know, we have got ongoing conversations with NHS England now because of that, which is great. But surely the government, society, the system as a whole should be doing the work already to ensure marginalised minority communities, not just ours, are supported in those spaces and given equity and equality to start their families.
I think this is such a powerful issue because there is so much heat, so much noise being made about trans people in our society. Yeah. But the day-to-day reality, and especially on something so personal as starting a family and what it mm-hmm. means for our family and for non-binary people, that's where the reality of that big noise and all the people who are on Twitter deciding that they think this is a funny debate, that's where I think they sometimes miss the reality for people. And it worries me when you talk about people feeling that our NHS, which I know many people feel so passionately about, isn't a safe place for people to get medical treatment, especially when it comes to starting a family. What can any of us do to help improve? I mean, I know what you might tell me as a politician I can do, and I promise you I'm working on that in terms of getting a different government in place. But these debates, people want to ask questions. People actually, I think, do want to be kind, but they don't know where to start. What can we do to help make society more inclusive for families like yours?
I think if we have to take it back to the root cause of where this all started, and I feel that as an organisation, what we see publicly and across society is post-pandemic, the world has got very hateful, very intolerant, very unaccepting of anyone, any marginalised minority group, anyone that's different, that doesn't look white, middle class, or working class, or whatever that may be. And sadly, that is where we are at the moment. Cost of living, inflation, you know, people are struggling in their own spaces. So it's that kind of, I'm all right, Jack attitude of I'll look after my own, but people that look like me, people that sound like me, people that have the same experience. Where did we get to this sad point as a society where we are battling different communities against each other? And what I'd like to put out there, and I think the fact that you have the platform for me to say this is crucial, that trans and non-binary people and people in our community or any community just want to exist safely. They want to go to work. They are taxpayers. They give back to the economy. Our children will be taxpayers. We want to live safely. We don't want to infringe on women's rights, men's rights, anyone else's rights. We just want a seat at the table. We just want the ability to access a service that provides care for us and be included in it. Have language that includes us, doesn't erase us. And to hear people in our community, and being one of them myself, that you access a healthcare system that does not reflect people that are like you is concerning. I'm a taxpayer, you know, the system should reflect people like myself or other people in the community. And I think the sensationalisation that happens, especially across the media and across politics, that trans people or people in our community are trying to erase women, are trying to erase gender, are trying to, you know, change society is absolute rubbish. They just want people to see them as humans and say, you know, that is your life. I might not agree with it. I might not understand it. But actually, you're just a human being who wants to go about life and exist happily. And wouldn't it be nice if we could all do that for each other? Does their existence impact you? No, it doesn't. Does us accessing healthcare services impact you? No, it doesn't. And I think that's where we've got to get to. Sensible conversations about what are we? Who are we as a community? Why can't we get along? Why can't we work together and co-produce and make a nicer, better society? Why is everyone attacking? And of course, we're never going to eradicate discrimination. We're never going to eradicate some of the conversations that happen in Parliament about our community. Sadly, they are people's views and we're not here to change that. That's never going to happen. But what we want to do is ensure that people can live safely and access services, and that the general public understand we are just people that want to get on with life, and the more allies we have, the better.
You're also mums trying to raise your family. How old are your children now? How long has you been involved in this work?
Well, nearly 12, 13 years. Our eldest is 10 nearly. Our second, he is 6. Our third child, she is 2. And our youngest is 5 months. So wow. We have them. We've been incredibly lucky.
And I feel that terror because they're both toddlers when, like, it's just me on my own with them, that sheer fear. And they both at that age now, well, they'll look me in the face as they're running off to do something really, like, they know they're not meant to do. And yeah. Because they think this is hilarious. I can't imagine what life must be like with 4 children to try and those age groups as well. Just talk us through a little bit about how that helps and impacts your campaigning and your ability to do the work you're doing, because that's a lot of work too, isn't it?
It is. And I also have a full-time job as well. on top of us running the organisation, my wife, you know, works full-time for the business. And we spend a lot of evenings, weekends, when the kids have gone to bed, supporting people, working on campaigns, reviewing guidelines, document, all the things. But, you know, the children are the reason that drive us, because we fought so hard to have them. You know, we spent in excess of £60,000 to have them. 13 years of, like, failed cycles, PCOS, miscarriage, birth trauma, you know,
secondary infertility, we ticked a lot of traumatic boxes, but we just want to ensure that people like us or others in the community don't have the same experiences that we did. And the fact is, our children are going to go on to become taxpayers. They could be the next midwife in the trust down the road or the next CEO of a company. We want to make sure that they're understanding of other communities, and you know, we do a lot of work with our children at home about acceptance, and the word intolerance or tolerance is not used in our house. It's about, if you don't understand, then you ask, and if you're not comfortable to ask, then you go away and you educate yourself. And all communities, all people deserve respect, and that is how they've been taught. But it's a scary world right now, because you know, there are conversations in the schools and with friends that are difficult for our children. And, you know, not many people would be happy with their children being told that their family aren't normal, or, you know, they don't agree with our community. And they're the conversations that sadly, you know, for example, my eldest has had really recently. And it's tough. It's tough on our children as well.
What can we do to support kids like your kids in school when those conversations happen? Because you're right, we can't block out the world, but we can help change it through the debates that we have. So just tell us a little bit more about that, and what you said to your child, and what we could be saying to children who maybe are asking similar questions, because they're hearing politicians and people in the public eye talk about these issues.
The difficulty is, Stella, there's a lot of learnt behaviour that is generational. It comes down through families, dependent on, you know, areas you live or who you are. And these children are picking these things up. They're hearing things. You know, children have social media, which I find frightening as it is, and something that, you know, we are very careful with our children. They don't have social media. It's hearing all the things that shouldn't be said, and they pick that up. So going into the school setting and saying these things to other children of colour or children of families like ours, all these different cultural communities or different communities, that's education is where we need to stamp it out. So when we had that issue with our eldest, we spoke to the school and they handled it wonderfully, and we told them about a charity, a UK-based charity called Diversity Role Models. And I would honestly urge everyone to speak to them or talk to their school about them. They're funded by currently by the Department of Education, and they get funding to go into schools to talk about differences, celebrate differences, talk about LGBTQ plus families, bullying, but also the intersectionality of being of colour, of having cultural needs, of being disabled, all of those different marginalised groups. And so they went into our daughter's school and they spoke to the children, and it seems to be having a real great impact. And if you cut in at the right at the beginning where education starts, you can unpick those stereotypes, those assumptions, those unconscious bias at a young age. But, you know, it's us as the older generation that we need to work on it too, to ensure that what we're passing down to our children, what we're talking about in front of them, is appropriate, is inclusive, is accepting, because that's the issue. They're learning from us, and that's where the problems lie.
Yeah, I learned the hard way that children are sponges, because my children started to pick up perhaps some of my language that I'd rather they didn't.
We all do.
Hearing them repeat it and you think, oh God, or in fact you use a word and you think, no, I must not use that word. Yeah. But also what you've said there is really powerful, because recently in Parliament there's been debates about not having sex education in schools, the idea that somehow we're damaging the innocence of kids. I really worry about what's being said in the playground and what kids are picking up from the world outside and what they're bringing into the school platform. So your experience of actually when you have that conversation with somebody who is trained to do it in a way that's age appropriate and can help.
Yeah.
I'm not sure anybody could try and persuade my daughter not to use swear words because she's heard mummy doing it, but somebody who is qualified about how to gently have those conversations about difference. Where else do you think we need to be having those conversations, and who else do you think we need to be having those conversations with?
Definitely education, definitely, you know, at every single point throughout school, into secondary school, into universities. I think it needs to be, you know, happen consistently. And I think when they start hearing those positive stories and hearing lived experience, that is the crucial part, not just hearing you need to accept everybody and that's that, because that's where's the so what. It's about hearing from people and seeing that human behind that community and saying, oh, they're actually really cool, or they're great, or, you know, I've learned something new today and maybe I've found a friend. That's the kind of society surely we want to grow into. And absolutely, there is an age where, you know, sex education should be taught. But again, you use the words age appropriate. Absolutely. No one wants to go in and have in-depth conversations with someone in reception about what sex looks like. But to understand relationships, what love means, also is really crucial. You know, we're talking about children that also are victims of domestic and sexual abuse. Where are we picking up those children that fall down the cracks? But if we're having those conversations and gently introducing at each stage older, more informative conversations, then that makes sense. And then they grow with the information and they become accustomed to, this is what relationships look like. I think that's a really, really important point to think about those children that are impacted, because they don't know what that looks like. And if you're not talking about it till secondary school, you know, up until the age of 11, not having those conversations about what healthy relationships and what sex is.
And what do your kids think of the campaigning and the advocacy work that you're doing?
I think our second, he's only six, he picks bits and pieces up and he'll talk about it. He'll go, Mummy's on the telly, or Mummy Stacey's doing this, that and the other. And, you know, it's nice. But for our eldest, I think it's helped grow a really kind and accepting little human being, because she looks, and she's just wonderful. She looks for, everyone loves their kids, right? We all love our kids. But I think the way she's grown, because she sees the thing, kind of things we do and how we support people, and we talk about it to her, and we have to explain. She goes, why are people so hateful? Why do people not like people of colour or people in our community? And yeah, we do have age-appropriate conversations about why. And she can't get her head around it at her age. She doesn't comprehend why people could be that nasty. But it's helped develop her acceptance for all people. And she is a little activist in the making. She does, you know, she does want to be the one that saves the world. I said, you can't always be the one that swoops in at every turn when you see things happening. But at least you know you're an ally to other children or other people. If you see something wrong, you speak up and you speak out. You don't let it pass. So I think, in a way, that's made us quite proud, because she is very gentle, very sensitive, and she considers people, not just their journeys, but their feelings. And I think, that's not woke. That's not snowflakey. That's just being a nice human being. And I think we've lost that as a society. We need to teach our children how to be kind.
I have to hope that my daughter will turn her capacity to argue night is day into a force for good, because right now she just uses it why she shouldn't have to go to bed at a certain hour of the day. So it's lovely to hear that actually your children can be around activism and use it as a force for good in the world.
Well, one of them, the middle two, are feral. They're crazy. So they're the ones that I birthed, sadly. So I take the brunt of the genetics from that end. But no, I mean, yeah, we're incredibly lucky, and I hope the other three will be the same. But I think a lot of the learning starts in the home. But if it can be picked up in the education setting, we can create a really nice society of people. And I think we need to get back to being kind again.
That's a good point, because obviously this podcast is called the Mumafesto. Every time I apologise to the guests for the bad pun, but we are in the run-up to a general election. So really, my biggest question to you is, what would you like to see on the agenda for that election and the issues that people could and should be talking about to make the world a better place?
I think there's so many areas, you know, that we've got to work on improving across society. I feel that there needs to be more compassion for those that are, you know, have disabilities, those that are in areas of social deprivation. It's kind of that, like I said before, that I'm all right, Jack attitude. We've got to think about society as a whole, and how do we upskill? How do we support those coming in the country? How do we support those already here? How do we ensure everyone gets a piece of the pie and get supported to be the best they can? How can we treat those humans better that pay our salaries, might I add, you know, as taxpayers? How can we ensure that all people are treated better? Equity and equality is something to work towards, but I think being kinder and just supporting families in the best way possible, getting people in Parliament, talking to people with lived experience to understand that tangible human side is important. It's very easy to stand and vilify people, for example, in our community, or trans or non-binary people, because you can't see or hear them. But actually putting someone up in those spaces and hearing what that looks like, and it's only, you know, throughout education and training that people gasp, or they go, oh, or they hide behind their hands. So I think that's the point. Let's get to the point where people don't hide behind their hands, or they don't go, that's terrible. What, you experience that all the time? You know, we've got to get to a point where we're not having to fight those battles.
Absolutely amazed that even just after you've given birth to a second child, I mean, like most people would just be on the sofa watching marathons of Netflix and eating too many biscuits. You've turned that that experience into such a positive force for education, understanding and awareness of the experience of different communities in our country of accessing healthcare services, and it's such a fantastic thing to see. And I'm hoping that today people listening to this will go and check out what you do and see what they can do to help and support those same-sex families in our communities as they're struggling through some of these challenges, because it is a really painful process at the best of times when you don't feel included and you don't feel seen and you're fighting that battle too. That is absolutely heartbreaking. So thank you so much, Lara Rose, for what you're doing and for coming today on the Mamafesto.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Lara Rose's powerful testimony about the impact of an accepting community and the positive things that can come from helping our young people understand and celebrate diversity within our world. If you've enjoyed what Lara Rose had to say, you can find out more about LGBT mummies on my website and via the social media. Thank you for listening to the Mamafesto.